Cassette 6, Side 2. Paul still created what Ophelia called little hurricanes. I came to the new offices once, hours after Paul had left town, and found Jim laughing, shaking his head. He had just looked in on the women who were now trying to manage Paul's schedule and travel and correspondence, and had found them in tears. Not because Paul had been cruel to them. "He's never mean," Ophelia had said, and this was true in my experience. This was a case of nervous exhaustion, a case, Jim said, of decompressing from Paul. The old frugality of PIH endured. The charity still used only about 5% of donations to administer itself, and all the rest on services to patients. Some months after they received the Gates grant, Farmer wrote an open letter to the organization. In it, he worried that PIH might be losing its way, morally. This because, among other things, some employees expected to be paid for working extra hours. He wrote, "One can never work overtime for the poor. We're only scrambling to make up for our deficiencies." Ophelia agreed in principle. She wasn't going to let PIH get bound and gagged by other institutions' rules, but she would allow some compromises, because PIH's connections to other institutions meant they could treat more patients. Their formal connection to Harvard obliged them to pay overtime to some of their lowest salaried employees. Ophelia, who managed such matters, was following those rules. She simply didn't tell Paul. About 20 people had worked at Partners in Health headquarters in Boston when I had first visited late in 1999. Now there were 50, and another 10 in Roxbury. The numbers in Haiti had grown to about 400, and to 120 in Peru, and they were about to inherit 15 employees in Russia, because on top of everything else, PIH had expanded to Siberia. This didn't happen by plan. It might not have happened at all if Alex Goldfarb hadn't involved himself in some mysterious relationship with the exiled Russian oligarch Boris Berezovsky. According to one published version of the story, a former KGB agent claimed he'd been ordered to assassinate Berezovsky, but had tipped him off instead, allowing Berezovsky to flee Russia with his Swiss bankbooks. Later, the KGB agent himself escaped to Turkey. And then Goldfarb did Berezovsky a favor by helping the KGB agent get to London. Meanwhile, the current Russian government claimed to have a legitimate legal case against the former KGB agent, and the authorities were furious at Goldfarb. So was Soros's foundation for putting their TB project in political jeopardy. A new director was needed anyway, because Goldfarb couldn't very well work in Russia now. He was quoted in a paper called the Russia Journal as saying, "Being a sane person, I would not go to Russia for a couple of weeks at least. I'm not a fool." After a flurry of emails, the foundation asked PIH to take over their project in the Siberian oblast of Tomsk. This was the site of the pilot project of pilot projects in the effort to stanch the Russian TB epidemic, the project that would show the way to controlling, in the prisons and the towns and cities, both drug-susceptible TB and MDR. "Tomsk has to work," Goldfarb had told me in Moscow. On that sentiment, Paul and Jim agreed. The project in Tomsk was vital. Jim was eager to add it on, even though he was already in charge of Peru and involved in the Boston projects. Paul worried. Partners in Health was stretched already. If they tried to do too much and projects faltered, there would be no end of people pointing out the failures, saying they'd shown that MDR and AIDS could not be treated in impoverished settings. But Paul agreed to take on Tomsk, provided that his role be mostly clinical, and that Jim assume the managerial chores and most of the diplomacy. Jim said he'd get to work right away, but he still hadn't gone to Russia when, about a month later, he and Paul and Ophelia went out to dinner together at a restaurant in Cambridge. I went along. "You said yes to Russia," Paul told Jim, not long after we sat down. His voice had the intensity of yelling, not the full volume, but it was rising. "You fucking promised me, and you're not gonna go?" Jim protested. He had planned to travel to Tomsk this month, but it turned out he had to attend TB meetings in Bellagio at the Rockefeller Foundation's estate on Lake Como. The meetings were crucial, Jim said. I don't care, Farmer said. His neck had turned red. The veins in it stood out. Fuck Bellagio. Bellagio, fucking Bellagio. You need to go to Moscow and Tomsk, where there's real work. You need to do some real work in Moscow. Then you can go to Bellagio and do your Harvard crap. He turned to Ophelia. All I'm saying, Min, is that he has to go. I said, you won't do it. I know it. You're going to cancel. You won't go. Now he's talking about Bellagio? The heck with Bellagio, Lago di Como. Look, I would like to go to my grave, never having gone to Bellagio. Paul said that Jim had gone to Moscow only once in his life, and hadn't even left the airport. That's not true, said Jim in a quiet voice. You went into town for the Bolshoi crap. I would have, said Jim, but they canceled the performance. Farmer turned to Ophelia. They canceled the Bolshoi, Min, but he would have gone. He went on, I'm going to go to Russia a couple of times this year, but I would like to focus on the things Jim told me I could focus on. He turned to Jim. What were they? You tell her. Jim smiled. The Bolshoi and dressage, said Ophelia. Farmer didn't laugh. He said to Ophelia, I'm asking him to limit the damage in Russia. She said softly, He knows that, PJ. Well, said Farmer, force him to do it. Jim turned to Ophelia. He's trying to irritate me enough. I know, she said. The times had grown rare when all three were in the same place at the same time. But even the nostalgic talk didn't sound nostalgic tonight. Ophelia said to Farmer, Jim used to pick you up at the airport. Used to, said Paul. You never picked me up, said Jim. That's what he always said, Farmer announced to the table. He said, you never picked me up, and you were coming from Los Angeles? Sorry. You never did, said Jim. Where were you coming from, said Paul. You were coming from Los Angeles, or Chicago. Yeah, yeah, said Ophelia wearily. I was coming from Haiti, said Paul. I wanted to talk to you about... What did I want to talk to you about? I talked about nothing? I always talked about Haiti. Anyway, said Ophelia, I've made my mistake, said Paul. I'll never do it again. I'll never ask you to pick me up again. That's not the point, said Jim. The point is, you never picked me up. Ophelia told me that Paul never let himself lose his temper when it might jeopardize PIH's missions. She didn't mind that he lost it sometimes in front of her and Jim. That was safe, she thought, and also probably good for Paul's psyche. After the dinner, she said to me, You think that was bad? What he was doing to Jim was nothing. On a scale of 1 to 10, that was about a 5. I guessed she was right. As Paul and Jim walked out the door, I saw Paul put his arm around Jim's shoulder, and Jim put his arm around Paul's, and I could see they were laughing. A few weeks later, Jim flew to Siberia. I went with him. It was 4 hours by plane from Moscow in a Russian-made Tupolev 154, which had a scarred wooden toilet seat in its restroom that I figured could not be older than the plane itself. Tomsk was a city of about 500,000, partially filled with Soviet constructions of steel and glass and cement block, and also with old wooden houses heaved into lopsidedness by many long winters, houses covered with fantastically ornate window casings and cornices. The city had several huge public buildings, classically porticoed. Tomsk's university was Siberia's oldest. The city had a reputable medical school and factories that made light bulbs and matches. It had electrified trolley cars and 5 competing internet providers. But Tomsk Air had gone bankrupt, and the airport, formerly the airport of the workers, received not the previous 47 flights daily, but only a handful. And the water, because of incipient flooding, wasn't safe to drink when we got there. Tomsk was a place where the war monuments were well tended, and residential backyards and front yards were full of junk, poking out of the snow. We stayed in a hotel with overheated rooms and sloping floors. I had a strange dream the first night there, of a landscape full of monuments in which derelict automobiles sat on top of marble pillars. Tomsk and the huge territory around it had a severe MDR-TB problem, but one that seemed likely to be brought under control, in part thanks to Alex Goldfarb's efforts. However, because of Goldfarb's other efforts on behalf of the KGB agent, rumors were swirling around everyone who worked in the TB project, rumors that they were really spies against the motherland, part of a nefarious plot in which the patients were serving as fronts. To quell local suspicions, arrangements had been made for the Vice Minister of Justice, who was in charge of Russia's prisons, to come to Tomsk and endorse the project and PIH's new role in it in front of TV cameras. The Vice Minister had agreed to do this, a Russian general told me, because of his friendship with Farmer. A banquet was planned. Farmer was supposed to attend. He got stuck in Paris, however. His latest assistant in Boston, a young woman, had made a mistake. He couldn't get his visa until the following day, so Jim had to go it alone. The banquet took place in what seemed like a VIP safe house, a small, luxurious private hotel tucked into a corner of a vast gray concrete apartment and shopping complex still under construction, a part of Tomsk called, for some strange reason, Paris. The event was important. Dots Plus would have no chance of succeeding in Russia without the ardent help of the generals who ran the prisons. Nor would the project in Tomsk if the generals didn't trust Jim, whom they'd never met before. But a stiff formality prevailed for the first 2 hours or so, in spite of dozens of toasts and half a dozen bottles of vodka consumed. The Vice Minister and 10 big-handed Russian generals and colonels in heavy olive-drab uniforms sat on one side of the assembled tables. On the other side sat the foreigners and the Russian doctors now working for PIH. The division seemed unbreachable. However, Jim had spied a TV equipped for karaoke, and as the fish course was being served, I heard him whisper, "I'm gonna do it." He stood, raising his shot glass. "I'm a terrible singer, but in my culture, Korean culture, if you respect someone and you have a deep affection and admiration for the people you're with, you should embarrass yourself by singing for them. So I will sing for you." Jim belted out, "My Way." The TV orchestra accompanied him. The words scrolled across the TV screen, and then the TV got stuck, and Jim went on alone, hitting a few sour notes. Everyone clapped, and then a member of Merlin, a British international health organization also working in Tomsk, got up and sang "Summertime," and then a two-star general ordered up a Russian song from the TV, a lively tune. The generals and the vice minister, Yuri Ivanovich Kalinin, clapping out the rhythm. Then one of the generals asked one of the Soros doctors to dance, and the Tomsk civilian TB chief, a man as large as a mature black bear, danced with a young woman from Merlin, and Jim sang "La Bamba," and another general followed with another Russian song, while images of Broadway and bathing beauties on Caribbean beaches rolled across the TV screen. And then something rather magical happened. Without warning, and without mechanical aids, Vice Minister Kalinin himself began to sing, in a deep baritone so clear it sounded trained, a lovely, slow, and mournful-sounding ballad, and all the generals and colonels joined in. The jailers of Russia together in song. I swear it was possible, given the hour, the quantity of vodka drunk, to enjoy that spectacle of comradeship without so much as a thought about what they had all been comrades in. I don't think I merely imagined that the farewell speeches were tinged with affection. "Dear friends," one general began, "I really mean you are my friends." "Bottoms up again," another general rose. "We have gathered around this beautiful table. All the people in the world have the same emotions. We just want to do something good for this earth." He raised his glass. "That we finish this work according to the DOTS program." He pointed to the vodka bottle in front of him. "Directly observed therapy." Outside, snowflakes lit the air. The generals drove away with a police escort, little sedans with whirling blue lights on their roofs. Jim watched them depart, his smile like the snowflakes in the dark. The night of the singing Gulagmeisters. We're not going to see that again soon. The next morning, Jim left, and Paul arrived. He stayed only one day, which he spent examining MDR patients and giving various press conferences with the vice minister. There was another banquet that night, a smaller, quieter affair in the same strange small hotel. At one point, Vice Minister Kalinin raised his glass and said,
"To Alex Goldfarb. He worked very hard and was sincere."
Farmer raised his glass. "To Alexander Davidovich. May he stay out of trouble." Halfway through the meal, a man with tousled hair, who looked like a figure in one of Goya's paintings of drunks, skin flushed, eyes squinty, wandered into the room. The interpreter leaned over to Farmer and explained that this man was a local oligarch, part owner of this place and also of Siberian gas and oil fields. The oligarch, meanwhile, was weaving his way to the head of the table. He squared his shoulders and declared,
"Dear guests, I would like to say a few words. Energy is the force of life. Tomsk Oblast has oil, coal."
He sucked at his teeth and corrected himself.
"Tomsk doesn't have any coal, and we have to use more and more of the gas. We will be able to supply the energy needs of several oblasts."
"Bravo!" cried one of the generals. "To the energy program!" cried Farmer.
"The moral of the story is that energy is the secret to everything in life," said the drunken interloper. "Thank you very much for coming to Siberia."
"I love Siberia," Farmer declared from down at the other end of the table.
The oligarch lurched away. For a moment, it seemed he was leaving, but he'd only gone to get a chair. He lugged it back to the table and sat down on it heavily.
"I do apologize for breaking into your life."
He cleared his throat.
"I have helped a lot already. I invest a lot in culture and medicine for the city."
Other conversations resumed around the man. He seemed to be talking to himself. "What's he saying?" I asked the interpreter.
"Now he's speculating about why the Russian life is so hard."
Finally, he wandered away, and soon the farewell toasts and the goodbyes began, the party moving out to the lobby. Farmer was dressed in a furry Russian hat and was saying goodbye for the third time to the vice minister. "I was very upset I wasn't here yesterday, but now I see that it's all right. We are waiting for your marching orders." He was lifting a military salute to the minister when, from a side door, the oligarch of oil and gas reappeared, naked except for a towel wrapped around his waist. He headed toward the billiard room, lurching past the vice minister, who smiled and shrugged and went back to saying goodbye. Moments later, the hotel manager, a buxom woman, fully dressed and in high heels and looking greatly alarmed, came running through the lobby pursuing the oligarch. I couldn't make out what was going on, and neither could Farmer, but, smiling gleefully, he turned and watched the chase. We flew to Paris the next day. When we were settled in the chilly cabin of the Tupolev 154, "Has it come to this? Have we reached that age?" said Farmer as we spread blankets on our laps. I asked him a technical question about TB control, reciting an opinion I'd heard. "Would that be accurate?" "Every account is partial." He smiled over at me. "Except mine." He went on, "I have to say, Ruskies are my kind of people." "I've heard you say that before," I remarked. "PIHers accuse me of saying it about everyone, but it comes in handy in my line of work, to like people." He made up a list of types who shouldn't be doctors. "Curmudgeons, sadists." Then he began the dismount of our short stay in Tomsk. The essence was a brief discourse on drugs. Low-cost second-line antibiotics would soon be on their way to Russia, but at the moment, various snafus had delayed their arrival. Other organizations now intent on treating MDR in Russia were still waiting for the inexpensive drugs. Farmer and Kim, by contrast, had gone to Tom White and asked for $150,000 and bought enough drugs at high prices to start treating a few dozen MDR patients in Tomsk right away. Why do that? Why spend $150,000 now on drugs for 37 patients if, by waiting a while, they could spend the same amount and buy drugs to treat 100? Well, Farmer said, project managers could afford to wait for low prices, but not all patients could. It's going to take resources to stop this epidemic, he said. And if you want to use money to buy the resources, fine. I don't care what you use. Use cowrie shells. Soon, Farmer went to sleep. He napped most of the way to the Ural Mountains, and I tried to digest what he'd said about money. It occurred to me that PIH would probably always be in some kind of financial jeopardy, because it was constitutionally impossible for Farmer and Kim to sit on resources, to wait for lower drug prices while MDR killed Russian prisoners, to save for an endowment for Zalmi La Santé while Haitian peasants died of AIDS. Their approach, especially toward money, was completely impractical, it seemed to me. And yet, it appeared to be working. Farmer was traveling more than ever, to familiar sites such as Peru and Siberia, including one trip all the way from Haiti to Tomsk for a 2-hour meeting, which he considered a great success, and to Paris, where he'd agreed to give a prestigious lecture series so as to spend more time with Didi and Catherine, and to New York, where he testified on behalf of a Haitian with AIDS who was at risk of being deported. He went to dozens of American and Canadian universities and colleges, preaching his O for the P gospel, and to South Africa, where he debated a World Bank official at an international AIDS conference. Africans must learn to curb their sexual appetites, the banker remarked, and Farmer replied, I want to talk about other bankers, not the world bankers, but bankers in general. My suspicion is they're not getting a lot of sex, because they spend a lot of time screwing the poor. He went to Guatemala to see some bodies dug up. Partners in Health had found a donor to pay for a mental health project there. The disinterment and proper reburial of Mayan Indians who had been slaughtered by the Guatemalan army and dumped in mass graves. One time, not long after he'd taken a fall in Kanj and broken both an arm and his tailbone, he flew all the way around the world, bound for Asia on TB business. I kept in touch with him by email. He wrote almost every day, and sometimes in person. Once, in the city of San Cristobal, in Chiapas, I stood with Ophelia and watched him from a little distance as he strode down a narrow sidewalk, a thin, long-legged white man in a black suit, weaving his way past brown-faced women in colorful Indian shawls hawking trinkets. Ophelia thought he looked like the mysterious figure at the start of a Graham Greene novel. Who was that man in the rumpled suit? And where was he going in such a hurry? I wasn't sure that the real answers would have been plausible enough for the novelist's purpose. The aim of that trip was to persuade PIH's tiny Mexican outpost to expand their public health efforts in the troubled, impoverished villages of Chiapas, an effort which, if successful, would oblige Farmer and Ophelia and Jim to do more fundraising. And the reason he was hurrying through the streets of San Cristobal at that moment was to get back to our hotel in time for a scheduled telephone interview with a radio station in Los Angeles, which wanted his views on AIDS. He returned to Boston, as always, for month-long tours of service at the Brigham. I followed him on a couple of memorable cases. A migrant worker from Mexico has been shipped to Boston from a hospital in Maine, suffering from Fournier's gangrene, a malady first described in France in the 19th century as lightning gangrene of the penis. The surgeon's debridement of the dead tissue has left the man's waist and groin looking like a side of butchered beef, and some on the house staff think it's time to consider hospice care. But Farmer says cheerily, he's going to walk out of here. And about a month later, the man does. A graduate student, a young man, has arrived at the Brigham very near death. Farmer is called in and at once corrects the house staff's diagnosis. It's toxic shock, he says, and adjusts the medications. 2 weeks after that, The man lies in his bed, delirious with fever, shaking so hard that from the doorway to his room I can hear his teeth chatter. The tips of his fingers and toes have turned black, and as I'm staring at him, thinking he won't make it to morning, I hear Farmer saying to the parents, "The next 2 weeks won't be a picnic, but the worst is over. He's going to walk out of here." In tears, the mother says, "We trust you. Thank you so much." 2 weeks later, the young man's father asks if he can't repay Farmer somehow. Perhaps he can buy him a car? He's on call one evening, driving through Boston, when his cell phone rings. "Paul Farmer, infectious disease," he answers. I gather the caller is another doctor, asking advice on a case. Farmer murmurs, "Uh-huh. I see." Then he asks, "Can you tell me what species of monkey it was?" Service at the Brigham was so gratifying to him that he sometimes wondered aloud if he should give it up. Every day brought interesting cases and the pleasure of working in a hospital staffed and equipped to the highest current standards in medicine, where he could order a brain biopsy and not have to raise money to pay for it. He got medically recharged during his stopovers in Boston, but they were hardly a rest. Noting that his suit now looked like something he'd found in a trash barrel, but knowing she'd never get him to a department store, Ophelia gave his assistants a tape measure. But during most of a month, he never stood still long enough for them to use it, and he left town in the same clothes. Email wasn't always an enlightening means of following Farmer on his travels, because he sometimes neglected to say where he was. But one knew that most of his trips began and ended in Haiti. Some of his friends and allies continued to think he should go there far less often and spend most of his time deploying medical troops on worldwide campaigns. Howard Hyatt felt that way more and more insistently until he visited Zami La Santé. It was Dr. Hyatt's first sight of the place. When he got back to Boston, he wrote in an editorial for the New York Times, "I have just returned from a health center in a country at the bottom of the economic heap. HIV infections are controlled as effectively in an area of Haiti as in Boston, Massachusetts. More than that, medical care there is delivered with skill and caring comparable to that seen in a Boston teaching hospital." Zami La Santé had moved him more deeply than anything he'd ever seen before, Hyatt told me. He said that what Paul had done in Cange had to be replicated, and he said he intended to spend whatever time he had left on Earth doing all he could to see that it was. Replicability and sustainability. In the case of Cange, these terms had the same meaning, perhaps. In Jim Kim's view, Zami La Santé wouldn't survive without the support of some large foundation or international agency, and it wouldn't get that support unless it was seen as something like a laboratory for the world, not just as a marvelous anomaly. At times, this kind of talk made Farmer testy. "It's galling," he told me in the winter of 2002. "It should be enough to humbly serve the poor." Within a few months, though, replicating Zami La Santé had become his main preoccupation. Ever since the advent of effective treatments for AIDS in the latter 1990s, there had been debate on how and where to use the antiretroviral drugs. The argument had a grand scale and great complexity, but in fundamental ways it resembled the debates about MDR treatment, most experts saying that only prevention, not treatment, was feasible in places like Haiti and sub-Saharan Africa. Others, and especially groups like ACT UP, calling the failure to treat not just immoral, but also foolish, since it was clear that prevention alone would not halt the growing pandemic. To Farmer, the distinction between prevention and treatment was artificial, created, he felt, as an excuse for inaction. He had long since weighed in speeches and books and in dozens of journal articles. Then, in August 2001, he published an article in the British medical journal The Lancet, describing the treatment and prevention program in Cange. At once, PIH began receiving requests for advice and information. At one point, I counted nearly 100. They came from ministries of health and consultants and charities from every continent. The Harvard consensus statement, an argument for worldwide treatment, which 140 of the faculty signed, cited the project in Cange. The new chief of WHO's TB division praised it in a letter to the New York Times. Meanwhile, the economist Jeffrey Sachs was dispersing the Lancet article far and wide. Sachs had visited Zalmi Lasanté himself, and he'd had much the same reaction as Howard Hyatt. Sachs wrote to me, "Paul's work, and his concept of high-quality medical care for the poor, has had a huge effect. I was able to use the example of his work in many key fora around the world in the past few years, with the U.S. Congress, the WHO Commission on Macroeconomics and Health, the White House, the U.S. Treasury, United Nations Secretary General Kofi Annan, etc. When I worked with the Secretary General to help launch the Global Fund to Fight AIDS, Tuberculosis, and Malaria, Paul's work was a key example. It's embarrassing that piddly little projects like ours should serve as exemplars, Farmer told me. It's only because other people haven't been doing their jobs. It did seem like a case of gross disproportion in cause and effect. In the world, about 40 million people were infected with HIV, and a program that was treating about 125 of those in rural Haiti had somehow acquired great weight. But Zalmi Lasanté's program was, in fact, unique, at least at the time of Farmer's Lancet article. Other small AIDS treatment and prevention programs were underway in poor countries, but Zalmi Lasanté's was the only one in an impoverished rural area that chose its patients solely on medical grounds and not on their ability to pay, the only one that provided expert care and treatment for free. The Global Fund, which Sachs helped to create, was a brand new institution financed by governments and foundations. The hope was to raise many billions of dollars annually to fight the world's three great pandemics. By the spring of 2002, it had collected pledges for only a fraction of the goal. Nevertheless, the fund had begun receiving applications for grants and approved, among others, Haiti's application, which PIH had helped to write. According to the plan, Zalmi Lasanté would direct a thorough AIDS treatment and prevention program through most of the Central Plateau. The project would, it was hoped, serve as a model for similar projects in Haiti's eight other departments and in other very poor countries. Every part of the task looked daunting, and politics promised to make the job both harder and more pressing. When President Aristide's government had been restored in 1994, a host of nations and international development banks had pledged their help in rebuilding Haiti. But contributions were already dwindling by the time of Aristide's re-election in late 2000. Now the United States was leading a concerted effort to block aid to Haiti's government. Not just American aid, but also grants and loans from other sources, including loans from an international agency that would have financed an increase in the supplies of potable water and improvements in roads, education, and the public health system. The stated reasons for this policy were various and changeable. The real reasons probably included long-standing institutional fear and distrust of Aristide, a hope that Haitians might blame him for the country's continuing decline, and general weariness with Haiti's problems. Farmer wrote to me about the blocked loans. "I think sometimes that I'm going nuts, and that perhaps there is something good about blocking clean water for those who have none, making sure that illiterate children remain so, and preventing the resuscitation of the public health sector in the country most in need of it." He added, "Lunacy is what it is." In Cange, at least, the effects of dwindling aid seemed plain. By 2002, the public clinics out in the Central Plateau had all but shut down for lack of cash. Impoverished peasant families had nowhere to go but Cange. They were flocking to Zalmi Lasanté in overwhelming numbers, four times as many as just 2 years before. Patients filled every hospital bed at the complex, and every reclining chair, and every space on the floors. In effect, the people of the Central Plateau were begging Zalmi Lasanté to do the same thing as the Global Fund asked. Just to enact one part of the plan, just to extend Zalmi Lasanté's program for preventing transmission of HIV from mothers to babies, looked as difficult as the nationwide MDR project in Peru, and that project ranked among the most complex health interventions ever undertaken in a poor country. Only 20% of women in rural Haiti received any medical care. An estimated 5% had HIV. To find them, Farmer's Team, a group of PIH and Zami La Santé doctors and health workers and Haitian government employees, would have to undertake AIDS education among about 500,000 peasants who were scattered throughout a mountainous region of about 400 square miles. They'd have to establish labs and testing centers in a place where the principal roads were nearly impassable even in good weather. As for transportation, Farmer wrote to PIHers, "We believe it's going to be donkey and bike and motorcycle and jeep." They'd have to train lab technicians to run those centers in places that had only intermittent electricity or none, and hire and train many additional community health workers to deliver prophylactic drugs twice a day for 9 months to each infected pregnant woman and for a week to each newborn baby. Because breast milk can transmit the virus, each mother would have to be provided with infant formula for at least 9 months, and because the formula would have to be mixed with local water, Farmer's Team would have to clean up the water supplies in dozens of places. The Global Fund money, $14 million for the Central Plateau paid out over 5 years, would go mainly for anti-HIV drugs and for hiring Haitian health workers and for fixing up the few public clinics that already existed in the region. But treating and preventing HIV would also mean treating and preventing tuberculosis. And when they set up clinics to treat those two diseases, people would come to them with other ailments, with broken legs and machete wounds, with typhoid and bacterial meningitis. A PIH project couldn't refuse to treat people who didn't have the right diseases, so they'd have to spread facsimiles of the medical complex in Cange throughout the vast, mountainous, famished département du centre. And if they were lucky and frugal, $14 million would get them started. But Farmer was elated. When he got word about the Global Fund money, he wrote to me, "I feel like weeping. The Haitians so deserve this." He wrote that he would study his schedule and cancel whatever he could so as to spend more time in Haiti. A few weeks later, he was in Tomsk, visiting patients and checking out the program there. Not long after that, he was in Barcelona, addressing the annual International Conference on AIDS. Once, arriving in Boston, exhausted after another of his light months for travel, Farmer told Ophelia that he heard two sets of voices. At one ear, he heard friends and allies saying he should concentrate on the big issues of world health, and, at the other ear, the groans of his Haitian patients. The voice of the world saying, "This meeting's important," and the voice of Haiti saying, "My child is dying." Once in a while, cramped in an airplane seat, he had talked to me about retiring to Cange, about wanting to stay put there and be just a country doctor. I didn't fully believe him, for as long as he could manage the travel, I thought, he'd be leaving Haiti for places like Tomsk and Lima, to doctor individual patients and to do his part fighting plagues and inequities in health, practicing his own combination of wholesale and retail medicine. But he'd always return to Cange. It seemed to me that he didn't have a plan for his life so much as he had a pattern. He was like a compass, with one leg swinging around the globe, and the other planted in Haiti. Chapter 25. The transit between Cange and Boston used to jar Farmer, back when he was a young medical student. He'd leave peasant huts full of malnourished babies and, arriving in Miami airport, overhear well-dressed people talk about their efforts to lose weight. The trip was unsettling in either direction. One day he'd be inside the teaching hospitals of Boston, receiving instruction in the highest current standards of medical care, and the next morning he'd be climbing out of a tap-tap, his face gray with dust, into the squatter settlement in the parched high ground above the dam, where there was no medicine, let alone standards of care. In time, he learned to make the transition more calmly. After a while, I realized I could do just as good a job treating my patients without getting angry, he told me. By then, I think, he He was transmuting anger into something that felt better, a dream of ending the disparities, at least the medical ones, that separated Boston and Cannes. The dream seemed impossible, of course, but he still held to it. I don't mean we should do bone marrow transplants in Cannes, but proven therapies, he'd say in lectures. Equity is the only acceptable goal. He had made progress. Zami La Santé now had decent facilities, including a good operating room, always sparkling clean. But it still lacked a lot of high-tech equipment. There was no blood bank, no CT scanner. Farmer intended to fix those deficiencies and more someday. In the meantime, on occasion, when he couldn't bring Boston medicine to Cannes, he'd bring a patient from Cannes to Boston. In early 2000, PIH had flown a young man named Wilnot to the Brigham. He had a rare congenital heart defect, which a team of surgeons fixed, waiving their fees. Several months later, near the beginning of August, a woman from the city of Hanchet, eschewing the dreadful public hospital there, floors of rotting wood, an open sewer out back, no medicine without cash, brought her son by tap-tap over the road to Zami La Santé. The boy's name was John. Like their deaths, the births of most Haitian peasants go unrecorded, so John's exact age was uncertain. He was probably 11 or 12. He and his mother were all that remained of their immediate family. John's father and his 3 siblings had all died during the past few years, apparently of various ailments. When asked what he thought those had been, Farmer adapted a mordant line from Graham Greene's The Comedians. "Haiti," he said. "They died of Haiti." John's mother called her life a series of catastrophes. Though far from unprecedented, the family history lent John's case a special urgency. The clinical facts made it singular. John had swellings in his neck, which at first glance resembled scrofula, cervical lymphadenitis, TB in the lymph nodes of the neck, fairly common in Haiti. But with scrofula, the nodes feel squishy. John's felt hard to Farmer's touch. And the proportion of white cells in his blood was much higher than usually seen in extrapulmonary TB. Farmer suspected some sort of cancer. A diagnosis that would take a few hours in Boston can take weeks when made between Haiti and Boston. Serena Koenig, a Brigham doctor in her early 30s, had arranged for Wilnot's operation and the fundraisers that had paid for his travel and hospital stay. Now, Serena found an oncologist at Massachusetts General Hospital who agreed to make the diagnosis for free. Of course, the oncologist needed a sample of tissue from John. Obtaining the tissue involved a tricky surgical procedure, one that Farmer didn't feel he should perform himself, if he had a choice. He sent word to a Haitian surgeon in Mirebalais, one he knew to be competent. The surgeon agreed to come to Cannes for several $1,000s, a very large fee in Haiti. It was raining in the Central Plateau, and fetching the surgeon meant braving the mud and swollen streams between Mirebalais and Cannes. The trip took 12 hours. The biopsy lasted until dawn. Farmer was scheduled to fly to Boston that morning. He brought John's blood and tissue samples with him, and Serena took them to Mass General in a plastic shopping bag. Zami La Santé didn't have the equipment to preserve the specimens in frozen sections, so they'd been placed in formaldehyde. This meant that the diagnosis itself took 4 days instead of just one. The news was bad. John had nasopharyngeal carcinoma, a very rare cancer, constituting less than 1% of all childhood malignancies. If caught early, however, 60 to 70% could be cured. At first, Farmer thought they could treat John in Haiti, administering the chemotherapy in Cannes. He got Serena to obtain the regimen from her contacts at Mass General. She was about to start buying the drugs, cisplatin, methotrexate, leucovorin, when an oncologist friend in Boston told her, "Serena, if you want to kill this child, there are less painful ways to do it." In fact, only a handful of hospitals in the United States had the right equipment and experience to deal properly with John's illness, so Serena and Farmer agreed they'd try to bring the boy to Boston. Farmer was very busy, of course, and had to follow a lot of the case from a distance. Serena did almost all the work. The hospital bill for John would come to something like $100,000. Serena begged and cajoled nonstop for 3 weeks. Finally, the authorities at Mass General agreed to take the case for free. But by now, a month had passed since John's mother had brought him to Cange. Serena still had to put together a pile of documents for Mass General and for the American consulate in Haiti so that she could get a visa for John. She didn't even know John's parents' first names. There was no more time to lose, so Serena made up names, Jean-Paul and Yolanda. Serena didn't speak Creole, and she figured that since John had never traveled beyond the Central Plateau, he was bound to be scared, flying to America without his mother. She knew a Haitian-American, a resident in internal medicine and pediatrics at Mass General and the Brigham, named Carol Smarth. Carol had spent parts of her childhood in Haiti. She spoke Creole fluently, and she was a friend of PIH. She'd worked for a few weeks at Zami La Santé. She agreed to go to Cange with Serena and help fetch John to Boston. Serena called Farmer, who was traveling. She was afraid John might have grown much sicker in the past month, and she asked Farmer what circumstances would keep them from bringing John to Mass General. "No circumstances," Farmer said. "It's his only chance." "What will I say if I'm asked why we're doing this?" "That his mother brought him to us," said Farmer, "and we're doing everything we can to help him." Serena's first sight of Haiti had horrified her. Zami La Santé had moved her. The whole experience of bringing Wilnot to Boston had changed her life, she felt. She was still employed by the Brigham and Harvard Medical School, but now spent most of her free time working for Paul and Jim. PIHers weren't all alike, of course, but many had impressive academic credentials. Many were religious. The majority were female, and a lot of those were, as Ophelia said, rather good-looking. The full description fit both Serena and Carol. As I hurried along with these two young doctors through Logan Airport, I noticed a lot of people glancing our way. Serena had brought two suitcases, one full of stuffed animals and toys for the pediatric ward in Cange. Carol had brought a gigantic bag, a bag of Haitian returning from the United States proportions. It was filled with medicines she thought they might need to get John safely through the trip. Carol also carried a plastic bag filled with water. Two shabunkins were finning around inside, goldfish for Farmer's new fish pond at his house in Cange. He'd asked that some be brought, if it wasn't too much trouble. He wouldn't be there when we arrived. He had to go to Europe for a scientific meeting. The head of Soros's foundation had asked him to go, and he'd felt he couldn't refuse. Right now, he was in a German castle, of all places. But his young colleagues were certifiably first-rate doctors from two of the world's best teaching hospitals, and it looked to me as though they'd thought of everything. Serena had been too busy with arrangements to sleep last night. Now she ran through the whole list of what she'd done and was still reciting it when we got on the plane. The plan was to get John a visa on arriving in Port-au-Prince, drive on to Cange, and bring him back to Boston the next day, in first class, with Carol sitting beside him. Farmer, always saving money so there would be more money to spend, had insisted by email that they not buy first-class tickets but use some of his own vast store of frequent flyer miles. The first part of the plan unwound smoothly, largely because of T. Fifi, one of Farmer's best and oldest Haitian friends, the person whom, above all, he could count on to get a thing done in Haiti. The Haitian godfather, Farmer called her. T. Fifi was small and quiet, usually smiling. When she met us at the airport, she said she'd managed to get John a Haitian passport. First, she'd had to manufacture a birth certificate. Serena said, "If you get him another one, could you make his mother's name Yolanda?" Everyone laughed. I myself felt a lack of reserve that should have made me nervous. I felt as if I were slipping into a holiday mood, embarked on another vicarious moral adventure which looked as though it would be painless. The American consulate granted the visa at once. Then, late in the afternoon, we headed north toward Cange, in the Zami La Santé truck. Nearly a year ago, I'd seen a sign at the foot of Mont Cabrit, where the paving gave out, a sign that announced the imminent rehabilitation of National Highway 3. Now, rust from the fastenings dripped down the face of the sign, but it was still in better shape than the road. Some rocks had been moved around at the foot of the mountain, but not an inch of the track had been smoothed or paved, and all the earth-moving equipment was gone, except for one machine parked about a third of the way up the slope, on its way to becoming a relic. "What happened?" I asked T. Fifi. She shrugged. She'd heard that the European and South American contractors had either wasted all the money or stolen it. A battered old truck had turned over on the road up the mountain, blocking the way. There was a traffic jam of tap-taps and camions, the truck's carcass at the center and a crowd milling around it. After a lot of arguing and failed attempts, in which a few people nearly got crushed, the crowd rolled the truck off to one side of the road. All that took a while. It was after dark when we turned in at Zamy-la-Santé's gate, and I felt again the relief of smooth pavement. By now a familiar pleasure, a secure feeling, which this time didn't last. Serena and Carol went right up to the children's pavilion. The place felt different from the last time I'd been there. The hospital didn't look quite as clean, or the walls as white, and the air inside seemed hotter, the flies thicker. But I don't think anything had changed, in fact. I think it was just that Farmer wasn't there. The hospital seemed less reliable without him, and the sight of John in his bed shocked me. This book is continued on Cassette 7.